and welcome to Addressing Alaskans, a program capturing community conversations in South Central Alaska. Join us each week on KSKA Anchorage and travel to different spots throughout our community to listen to local groups gathered to discuss what matters to Alaskans. This week, we're at the Alaska World Affairs Council. Recorded on December 9th in Anchorage, President and Director General for Shell Companies in Mexico, Marta Jara presents Global LNG, a Shell View. That's coming up next on Addressing Alaskans after the news. You're listening to Addressing Alaskans on KSKA Anchorage. This week's program was recorded at the Alaska World Affairs Council in Anchorage on December 9th.
Hello, welcome everyone. Welcome and good afternoon. Hello, I'm Lisa Falsko, CEO of the Alaska World Affairs Council, and it's great to see everyone today. I'd like to introduce our head table. To my far left, we have Mr. Joe Beadle from Northrim Bank, who's the sponsor of the whole entire oil and gas series, and we are very appreciative to Northrim for making this possible, and our other partners, thank you very much. And to his right, you may recognize from KTUU MarketView, Mr. Garrett Wong, but he is also the chairman of our board and makes my job wonderful every day. Thanks, Garrett, for joining us and being the chairman of our board. And he'll come to the podium to introduce our speaker.
Well, thank you, Lisa. And it is my pleasure to introduce our speaker today. However, I have to make a few comments first. We were billing Mr. Jose Lima from Shell Oil Company, but due to a family emergency, he had to divert his trip to Brazil. And so, in his stead, we were going to ask President Barack Obama to join us today, but he didn't know too much about LNG. So, instead, we've invited Ms. Marta Jara, who is the President and Director General for the Shell Companies in Mexico, to join us today. And so, I'm going to give you a little background about Marta's background, and then we're going to invite her up to the podium here. Marta, she holds the executive position on the board of the British Chamber of Commerce and chairs its energy and environmental sector group. She is the chair of the Mexico-Dutch Business Committee, COMICE. Further, she has served on the editorial board for energy matters of the national newspaper Reforma over the last 2 years. Marta Jara is a chemical engineer and graduated from the University of Buenos Aires, Argentina. And she also holds a master's degree in strategic financial management from Kingston University in the UK. She started her career with Shell in 1991. Marta has held different management positions in the oil products manufacturing and natural gas projects in Latin America. She's also served in an advisory role in corporate offices in London. In Mexico, she participated in the development of the first LNG regasification terminal at the port of Altamira in Tamaulipas. She's also had a hand in the development of the LNG regasification terminal in Ensenada. Please extend a warm Alaskan World Affairs Council welcome to our speaker, Marta Jara.
Hi, good afternoon. I'm really excited for being here today. I'm not a Mexican. I'm actually from Uruguay, a 3 million state, a 3 million people state in the South Atlantic. So being here for me is like amazing. And so don't put me on a hard spot. I'm not a specialist on Alaskan matters. My area of expertise is in global markets. I've worked for gas monetization for the last 10 years, and in particularly in development of LNG projects. So that's what I'm going to try to address today for you. I think this invitation is very timely. The energy industry is characterized by long cycles that are sometimes interrupted by discontinuities and that create change and volatility. And if you think back about the last 2 years or so, we've seen very dramatic events that are shaping the trends. So what I'm referring to is the unrest in the Middle East that has put pressure on crude oil supplies, the earthquake this year in March in Japan with the tsunami and what it meant for the nuclear industry. The consequence of that, for instance, is that Germany decided to stop its nuclear plants until by 2022. And of course, we are still feeling the impact of the event in Macondo, with companies only now going back to drill in the Gulf of Mexico. So I think we can be pretty sure that we are in one of these moments of volatility and uncertainty. So this is the usual disclaimer. We're going to talk about the future. We're going to offer you some thoughts and views about the future, but don't really rely on them and make us responsible for that. Okay? So looking at the big picture for the future, we build scenarios at Shell. As you know, we've sort of invented the discipline of scenario planning, and we've just released our last series of long-term energy scenarios. And what we believe is that there are three big trends that will shape the energy future. One is obviously rising demand. If the emerging economies keep on their historical track record of growth, we're going to see a huge increase in demand, and basically also driven by population growth. We believe we're going to be 9 billion people in the next decades from 7 billion people we are now. That alone creates a huge pressure on demand. We are going to be very concerned about security of supply as easy oil runs out, and we need huge investments in the energy industry. So according to the IEA, some $33 trillion of cumulative investments in the global energy supply infrastructure will be needed only between 2010 and 2035. And obviously, the third big driver is that we're going to have to manage the impact on the environment and on society. And that will mean that we'll need to shift the energy matrix to less carbon-intensive fuels. And we're going to see a huge increase in energy sources like biofuels, wind power, and solar energy. But we believe that hydrocarbons will still remain over 60% of the global energy supply, with renewables moving from something like 13 to 30, and nuclear making up for the rest. In a nutshell, we are going to need all forms of energy sources to help us fuel the huge demand increase. So, against that background, I think it becomes really clear why natural gas is a key fuel for the present and the future. If you only look at the economic side of it, we know that natural gas is the fastest way to deliver power, power supply. So you can build a gas power plant much faster than you can build a coal power plant, and the costs in terms of capital are very, very advantageous to gas-fired power plants. And even the running costs are more advantageous than coal, wind onshore, or wind offshore. If you think about the environmental aspects, coal power plants have been responsible for more than 40% of the CO2 emissions driven by energy in the world. So we all know that turning to natural gas is the fastest way to mitigate climate change in the coming years. Well, If we talk about natural gas and the role it will play in the global markets, we need to talk about LNG. And LNG has been a very fast growing segment, and we predict it to grow at the same pace, about 6% per annum in the coming decade. Look a little bit about the geographic split of the LNG growth, and all the emerging economies in Asia, China and India mainly, are going to drive the big demand surge, and 66% of all new demand is going to come, in our view, from the east of Suez. There's also a demand for LNG in Europe, and that is also driven by the need for diversity from a geopolitical perspective. So Europe will also be growing its take of LNG. And obviously, for North America, although there are many regasification plants and there is infrastructure to bring in LNG, we don't see that any LNG is going to come to North America. Sorry. If you look at the supply, there's a lot of supply coming from Australia in the future. You know that Qatar has become the biggest LNG supplier, but now Australia has some 20 million ton per annum in projects that are very likely to become successful, and we believe they are going to become one of the main suppliers of LNG. And one of the things that is also driving the ability to supply this enormous gas needs is the new technologies that are going to allow to liquefy gas offshore. So if you have fields offshore, you're going to be able to monetize that gas through floating LNG. And that will make resources available that otherwise, because of their scale or their remoteness, couldn't be made available for production. Let me tell you a little bit about Shell in LNG and why we are leaders in it. We were the first company to produce LNG in 64. We started in Arzou in Algeria, and we've been pioneers both in creating new markets and in driving the technology with a very, very big track record. LNG, one of its main people seek LNG most of the time for security of supply. So the reliability of the supply chain is extremely important for customers. So being able to deliver on the contractual obligations flawlessly is one of the most important attributes for an LNG supplier. For instance, in Brunei, our plant in Brunei started in the 70s, and we've delivered more than 5,000 cargos without any hiccup for more than 40 years. So this is one of the key credentials of Shell, apart from the deepness of its portfolio. We have many liquefaction joint ventures. We have a very big trading arm, and we have regasification positions. For instance, in Mexico, we have two terminals, one on the Atlantic and one on the Pacific, and this delivers us access to key markets. On the side of technology, let me come back for a moment on floating LNG. Floating LNG is a new technology. Shell took final investment decision on one of these big hardwares. If you think about it, a floating LNG terminal is going to be the biggest floating object in the world. It's like four football fields put one after the other, and it's going to weigh more than six times the biggest aircraft carrier. So it's a huge kit. And The reason why it is so big, it's because it's meant to withstand huge currents at sea. So the design specifications for this plant is that it's going to be able to withstand more than the gas winds that came with Hurricane Katrina. We are going to develop this first plant in Australia on a site called Prelude, which is 200 kilometers offshore of Northwest Australia. The philosophy behind this plant is design one, build many. So once this concept is proven, we believe we're going to be able to deploy this same concept in different projects in different locations. If we talk about gas monetization, so LNG is clearly the biggest market for it, but there are other options for gas monetization, and one of them is gas to liquids. Shell just started up the biggest project, which is a 170,000 barrels per day project in Qatar, that synthesizes diesel from gas. So this allows to convert gas into a liquid fuel which can be transported and can substitute diesel derived from oil. This plant is so huge that we can fill over 160,000 cars a day, and part of the product slate is also synthetic lubricant, and we could lubricate more than 225 million cars. The construction of this plant was a marvel in terms of the deployment of people and infrastructure that came with it. We had at the peak of construction more than 52,000 people working on the site from several nationalities, and one of our main sources of pride is that it had an excellent safety record. So this is a new breakthrough. Some of the plants existed. There was one even here in Alaska. But the commercial scale is really the technology breakthrough that has happened this year. There is another possible application for gas in transport, and that is LNG for transport. So we believe that gas will play in the future an important role in transport when we talk about electric cars, and mainly in China, for instance, we're going to see gas turned into power and power turned into electricity that charges electric cars. This is longer term, but in the shorter term, we want to try the concept of LNG for heavy duty fleets. There are certain applications that we believe can be very economic, and we have just taken final investment decision on what we call a green corridor. We are going to make available LNG for transport in the Shell Flying J truck stops in Alberta. And we are going to also, in order to supply these stations, we're piloting another concept which is called micro LNG. So at our jumping pound in the foothills of Alberta, we're going to liquefy LNG at a smaller scale and deliver it to this network of stations. This is, again, a very novel concept and provides another option for LNG. So we've talked about global markets, and we've talked about different technologies and ways that we can use to monetize gas and deliver it to global markets. So I want to just close by giving you some thoughts about what can be the impact of this on Alaska. So as you know, Shell doesn't have any gas resources in Alaska, so you know, we offer our views just as an interested bystander, and we hope to get a seat at the table in the future when we are finally obtaining permits to be able to start drilling here in Alaska. So we believe that there are plenty of gas resources here in the state. And on the other hand, we believe that the situation in the lower 48 is going to remain, as we see now, with very stable and actually cheap prices for gas, which are going to make a pipeline project to export gas into the lower 48 economically not really viable or attractive. So it is in your interest really to look at all the monetization options that go from LNG to GTL to LNG to transport. You need to keep all those options open, and you need to think that all of the projects have obstacles everywhere, but here in Alaska, due to the Arctic conditions, capital costs are higher and developments are more difficult. But we believe that with all the technologies available, the industry and Shell in particular can work to safely and effectively develop the resources of Alaska, partnering with local firms, using the very skilled workforce, and providing a source of revenues, tax benefits, and contribute to the development of the state. So thank you very much, and I'm happy to take any questions you might have.
This is KESKA Anchorage, and you're listening to Addressing Alaskans with Marta Jara, President and Director General for Shell Companies in Mexico. Her talk entitled Global LNG, A Shell View, was recorded at the Alaska World Affairs Council in Anchorage on December 9th. Following her talk, Marta responded to questions from the audience.
Currently, there is a very significant price premium between the Pacific Basin, Far East, and particularly the lower 48, and also to Europe.
Also?
Well, somewhat less, but there is still, I believe, I understood that there is still a premium there. However, this particularly with regard to the differential between lower 48 prices and Pacific Rim prices, that offers the opportunity for development of an LNG project targeted at the Pacific Basin. Mm-hmm. But it depends on that premium continuing. What is Shell's view on that?
As you know, there are many projects that are being developed to turn some of the existing regasification facilities into liquefaction facilities. Even on the West Coast, the only regasification terminal is the one in Ensenada, and it's an obvious candidate for that too. The project would be based on the arbitrage, and we need to take a future look as how sustainable that is. We believe that the prices in North America respond to well-understood fundamentals. There are more than 100 years of resources, so it's obvious that they're going to be try to be monetized through exports. On the Asian side, we think that the demand growth mainly will drive high prices, and there are some developments for production of tight gas also in other geographic regions, but we believe that for a while prices will remain oil linked in the Pacific Rim. Yeah, and for instance in Europe we don't think that because of the characteristics of producing shale gas and tight gas with a high population density that this will boom in the same way that it boomed in the US. But I mean, for those of us that have been in the industry long enough, we know that we take a view and scenarios, you know, might turn out differently. So we still think that export projects, based on the fundamentals that we see today, are robust, and the arbitrage will continue.
Thank you for a very interesting talk. Why does a hydrocarbon-rich country like Mexico import LNG, and where is it coming from, and where does it go, and how is it used?
Okay. So when the terminal was built, this was starting in 2003, Mexico needed to build new power infrastructure, and the main problem that the developers, the independent power developers, saw was the uncertainty around gas. So in order to keep the pace of power investments, the utility, Mexico has a monopoly for power production, decided that they couldn't rely on the oil company to give sufficient assurance of gas supplies. This was, of course, again, before shale gas and so on. So even the U.S. Couldn't be seen as a reliable supplier going forward. The pipeline infrastructure coming from South Texas was already saturated, and building a new pipeline didn't make a lot of sense. So the utility ran an international public bid, which was won by Shell, and we committed to supply 15 years of LNG and took the bet of building the first regas terminal in Latin America. And now, of course, every cargo we deliver to Mexico destroys a lot of value, because that cargo has a cost of opportunity of three times or so of the price that we get in Mexico, which is linked to the Henry Hub. So we believe that, you know, in the coming years, there's sufficient value that probably new infrastructure, and Mexico is already talking about new infrastructure, will allow to bring more gas from South Texas and will enable LNG diversions to higher paying markets. But your question was more about why is the hydrocarbon rich country not producing its own resources. And I think one of the answers for that is that there's just one company, as you know, also on hydrocarbons are a monopoly in Mexico. And if you give an oil company $1, it's invested in oil and not in gas, because that delivers the highest netback. But having said that, now that Mexico has also become aware of the shale gas potential, the IEA produced a report this year saying Mexico was, I think, the third country in terms of shale gas reserves. They want to change the framework to make it attractive for private participation and to start producing their own gas. The gas is coming from all over the world. So we had Nigeria, of course, Qatar, Trinidad, and we even had Australian gas at times. So mainly from the Atlantic Basin, but the suppliers to the terminal are Shell, 75%, and Total, 25%, and each of the companies sources the LNG from their portfolio. It has come from Algeria, but I would say the biggest part is from Nigeria. Okay?
Do you think that there's any possibility that a new regasification plant would be sited on either the U.S. West Coast, Gulf Coast, or East Coast, and what would Shell's role be in that?
Obviously, regasification is not fashionable anymore for North America, and it's more trying to turn the existing regasification infrastructure, its utilization has been really, really low. So it doesn't make any sense to build new regasification. So all the companies involved are trying to turn these facilities into liquefaction facilities. And there's only one terminal, the Sabine Pass terminal, which has obtained a permit from the Department of Energy to do that. All the other applications that have been submitted for turning these plants into liquefaction plants are like under a moratorium because the DOE is saying we are not yet ready to open the gates for all this gas to be exported to non-FTA countries. Yeah, but we believe it's a matter of time because North America turned from a perception of deficit to a perception of surplus, and with time, policymakers, I think they will realize that they have more that they can use domestically, and that the wise thing to do would be to allow for exports. Okay. Yes.
Yes, in terms of global LNG supply and demand, what would you anticipate in that go-forward view? What could be absorbed in terms of additional supply into the LNG market? I'm thinking of the vast opportunity that we have here in Alaska, and I'm trying to see, in terms of the global demand, how much you would forecast could be absorbed.
We believe that the growth of the market will rather be constrained by supply and not by demand. Yeah. So the world is now consuming a little less under 300 BCM per year, and by 2030, I think it is, we expect it to be almost 500. Yeah. So it's a huge growth what we are forecasting, and some of the projects are in places that are difficult to pass the hurdles of investment decisions, yeah, and they're always subject to delays. So one day of average delay in all the known projects is equivalent to something like 30 BCM that the market becomes short. There's a lot more regasification infrastructure than there is supply availability. So all these fundamentals point to a market that we know for sure is going to be tight till 2016 or so because of the lead times of the industry. We can tell that already. But going forward, you need to have a lot of faith in the supply projects in order to believe you're going to have a balanced market. And when we think about the scenarios for a balanced market, in the base case, we count on projects in the Arctic, yeah, like Stockman in Russia. So we know these are very challenging projects from a technical point of view. And we also count on projects in North America. So what I was just talking about, it's subject to policies that allow the export to happen. So that is an uncertainty that needs to be taken into account.
Thank you. Thank you so much for coming. Thank you for your message. There are many Alaskans for many years have felt that our natural market for our natural gas is LNG and is to Asia. As you may know, Alaska's markets for almost everything is Asia, and we're so close to Asia. But getting that across to our public officials has not been easy. I think your speech will help. However, my question has to do with where you were talking about the products that can be used or are being used to fuel trucks.
Okay.
And I was recently at a meeting of the environmental arm of NAFTA in Mexico City last May, and they were talking about all the pollution as the trucks coming from Mexico into the U.S. are waiting to get cleared. They're sitting there, they're pumping out all these the greenhouse gases. And I said, well, why don't you find a way to transfer or change those trucks into running off of natural gas, off of LNG? Are you telling me that that's available and it just needs to be advanced?
Technically, it is available, and there are OEMs that already manufacture trucks with engines that can run on LNG. I think it's more of an innovation from the commercial point of view, because like every solution, you need to think about how to make it commercially attractive, you need to turn all the infrastructure. So for all the players in that, it's a bet. So if you are a fleet owner, for instance, you have your trucks, and part of your business model is that you, after you use them 5 years, you sell them to a second-tier truck owner. Well, is that second-tier truck owner also going to want to buy an LNG truck rather than a diesel truck? So until the market takes off, you need to start seeding the concept through alliances and things like that. And you need to start in a small geography where you can concentrate sufficient fuel stations and so on. So that is why we are just piloting it. Yeah, and we're also looking at it in Mexico and things like that, but we need to realize that you need to convince many of the stakeholders that this is a safe bet and that is sufficiently attractive. But it's not really a technical problem. The other interesting thing, and that is why I mentioned the concept of LNG for trucks, has sort of its supply mirror with the concept of micro LNG. So there are many isolated small-scale gas sources that are ideal for supplying a little play like that. So we are also constructing the first modular micro LNG that can then be replicated at different sites. Okay. Finally.
Thank you. The mic is finally moving. Thank you very much for your presentation. I wondered if you could follow up a little bit more on the Asian market and what you see as the role of Russia in the future, and if you see that market being dominated primarily by Australia and Russia, or any other opportunities for other entrants, geographical entrants in that market.
So, as I said, we think Australia is really taking the lead in LNG supply. And I think you can connect to that idea if you think Australia is an island and Russia is not. So, currently there is one big LNG project in Asia, which is Sakhalin. Yeah, we are participants in that project. It's an Arctic project again, so you know when there were delays there, it's very much like in Alaska. You don't have a few months delay. Usually you have a year's delay because of the season and so on. There's another project that has been in the brewing for 10 years or so called Stockman, also Arctic and very challenging. And I think the sense of urgency in Russia to advance the LNG projects is less because they have a more obvious monetization option, which is the pipeline gas, and they are the biggest pipeline gas supplier into Europe. Yeah, we know that Europe is a little bit. It's always a little bit concerned about having all the eggs in one basket. So they look at Russia. They have lots of supplies from Russia. But if you follow the markets, you know, for instance, that there was problems with rights of way in Ukraine, and Europe was very scared during the winter to have their supplies cut off. Their other source is the Middle East. It's also not looking very, very stable either. So I think Russia is one of the biggest gas producers, but it's not, and I don't think it's going to be one of the biggest LNG producers.
Will other countries come into the Asian market?
Well, Qatar is huge. And in terms of reserves, they can build as many projects as they like, but they imposed a moratorium a few years ago, and now all the projects that had been sanctioned before the moratorium are coming on stream. So it remains to be seen if they open up again the cycle for new investments. Australia has many, many projects. Indonesia, who was a traditional supplier, is running out of the known fields, is looking at other fields. And there are other projects in the Middle East and so on, but if you want to concentrate where the projects are going to be, it's mainly in Australia. And if floating LNG proves to be as successful as we believe, that is going to enable many of those Australian projects, because we're talking about many offshore developments there.
Mm-hmm. I want to know what the impact of different... What the impact of different government fiscal policies are on the global LNG market?
That's a very, very difficult question. Because, you know, there's nothing like a global fiscal policy. It's all local fiscal policies. And when we look at our scenarios, you know, you think about things that can put pressure or release pressure from the supply-demand balance. And public policies in general is a wild card that can make it work either way. Yeah. So if the United States decides that they want or they don't want to be a big exporter, has nothing to do with technical or economic, you know. It's really a difficult trend to predict, and it can make all the difference, yeah. And the same happens when you talk about incentives for gas production, tax breaks for the construction of projects. So all these things can really make or break the way the market develops. If you have, for instance, very tight CO2 targets in Europe, well, that creates more demand for gas. In the case of Europe, a lot of it comes from LNG, so that will put pressure on the LNG market. So you see what I mean? It's all these policies, the way they play in the different locations and the way they sum up is one of the most tricky questions to when you try to answer or talking about the future. Yes, sir.
Question over here. Thank you very much for coming. I have met Mr. Lima a number of times in Houston in your corporate offices, and I hope all was well with him. My question has to do with your LNG terminal facility proposed out of Kitimat, British Columbia. Mm-hmm. And I was wondering when you would expect FID for that, the source of gas, and the BTU content for that gas.
Okay. One of the things we are not ready to talk in public is to make any projections about FID and capacities and so on. And regarding the BTU content of that, I don't really have the information. But I can try to get it to you if you're interested. Okay, we'll do that.
Hi, you mentioned that the GTL plant in Pearl, at Pearl in Qatar, was up and operating. We've heard from other sources that it is heavily subsidized and would not be profitable were it not for those subsidies. And I was wondering if you could speak to that issue. Is GTL a feasible option without substantial subsidies from governments? Mm-hmm.
So GTL is a very capital-intensive development, so it's not a monetization option for all cases. You need to have a very, very cheap gas, and that is the case of Qatar. Yeah, if you are talking about GTL in other locations where the gas is more expensive, and sometimes in the cost of the gas you also include things like royalties, etc., it might not be economic viable. So I guess the answer is GTL is not a monetization option for all cases, and it's very challenging in economic terms. So when you build a GTL plant, you need to work on all economic drivers, and some of them is lowering the capital costs. So as we build more plants, we're going to get better at that. But sometimes the tax component can also be determinant.
You mentioned that North America, the supply perception rapidly shifted from a sense of shortage to that of oversupply due to the shale gas development. I was wondering, from Shell's view, do you regard the development of shale gas globally in China, Argentina, Poland, wherever else, as a threat to your to the future growth of LNG?
I don't think we regard it as a threat. We think the shale gas will develop not so much in Europe. As I said, it's much more challenging because of the density of population. But in China, we certainly think it's going to be a new source of gas, and it's not necessarily competing with LNG. And we don't talk only about shale gas. We talk in generally about tight gas. And for instance, in Australia, Shell and Sinopec have bought Arrow Energy because of their coal bed methane sources, and it's a new source of gas. It's not necessarily competing with LNG. We believe China, Argentina are all places that have a big potential for increasing the gas production. So basically, Shell is one of the companies that has a gassier portfolio compared to its peers, and we're really betting on gas in all forms, because we think it's a transition fuel. It's a little bit of an understatement. It seems like a destination fuel for many of the decades to come.
I'd like to join in thanking you for coming. I think I've been a member of the organization a long time, and I think you're the first Uruguayan that's ever spoken to us.
It's a very exclusive club, very few of us.
And by definition, all of our members know exactly where Uruguay is. I wanted to ask you about Nigeria. Shell has received a lot of highly unfavorable publicity out of what happened there. I understand that the civil war there had an enormous effect in terms of the environmental degradation. I'd just like to hear you comment on the present status of your work in Nigeria from an environmental point of view. What is going on? How much risk is currently involved in your extraction of gas and other petroleum products there?
So I'm not an expert on our operations in Nigeria, but I can give you one or two key messages. So we were one of the first companies in the country. We've been there for more than 30 years, and we have a huge infrastructure. Most of the environmental effects or the spills are caused by sabotage and thefts and so on. Like 70% of the spills are caused by these types of activities, and it's really very difficult to manage. Part of the history is that Nigeria has had huge tax revenues because of the oil business, but most of its people haven't benefited from that. So that is what spurs all this unrest. So we treat all the spills very seriously, and we deal with them, but it's difficult to control them at the source. We have a big investments there. So in LNG, there are 5 LNG plants where Shell is a joint venture partner. And we are committed to Nigeria and keep working in this very difficult environment. I don't have many more details, but I think this is sort of the yeast of what happens there.
Well, it looks like we're done with questions.
Thank you.
Marta, again, thank you very much for your comments.
This is KESKA Anchorage, and you've been listening to Addressing Alaskans with Marta Jara, President and Director General for Shell Companies in Mexico. She responded to questions from the audience following her talk entitled Global LNG, A Shell View, recorded at the Alaska World Affairs Council in Anchorage on December 9th, 2011. You can download today's program or subscribe to free podcasts of Addressing Alaskans at alaskapublic.org. To let us know about an upcoming community event that you would like to hear on Addressing Alaskans, Just go to alaskapublic.org and click on Contact Us at the bottom of the page. This has been a production of KSKA Public Radio in Anchorage, Alaska. For KSKA, I'm Kristen Spack. Thanks for listening.